New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Welcome. I'm Christopher Naughton, happy to be working alongside longtime host Jeffrey Mishlove and co-host Emmy Vadnais. Quick note right here at the top, please click on like, comment, or subscribe. It helps get programs such as these out to people like yourself. Well, six decades ago, the term NDE or near-death experience wasn't even a thing. Of course, it had been with us since the dawn of civilization, but the intersection of two personalities in the 1970s at the University of Virginia would change all of that. Dr. Raymond Moody, who would eventually write the book Life After Life, was collecting stories of NDEs, and he was a student of Dr. Bruce Grayson, who had also been collecting his own stories, would dive deeply into the research of NDEs, and the rest, they say, is history. My guest today is Dr. Bruce Grayson. He is the Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia. He is the author of this book, After a Doctor Explores What Near-Death Experiences Reveal About Life and Beyond. He is the former chair of UVA's Division of Perceptual Studies Program, also known as DOPS, and the founder of IANS, the International Association of Near-Death Studies. In this conversation that I had with Dr. Bruce Grayson, which I conducted in tandem with a seminar I was teaching on the one mind, Dr. Grayson revealed to me that almost 30% of NDEs are accompanied by a life review. Here's my conversation with Dr. Grayson.
Well, let's start here, Bruce. You know, I didn't realize until I did a deep dive into some of your work and your background that there's really a very interesting intersection between you and Raymond Moody, who wrote the seminal book, Life After Life. I mean, it's an interesting Rubik's Cube. Tell me about that intersection.
Yeah. Well, Raymond started his psychiatric training at the University of Virginia about the same time that I started on the faculty at University of Virginia. And my job was covering the emergency room and supervising the psychiatric residents seeing patients in the emergency room. And that was Raymond's first rotation there in the summer of 1975. And that was about the time his book came out.
He had already been doing some of this work. In other words, he had actually been gathering these stories. Now, you're at UVA, you're a psychiatrist, you're on the faculty there as well. By this time, you're pretty well aware of Ian Stevenson.
Yes.
Stevenson had been doing NDEs, but he had been really researching kids in reincarnation.
Yes, he had actually been collecting stories of NDEs before this, but we didn't have a name for them. So I knew that Raymond had written a book, but I didn't know what it was about until one day we were sitting in the emergency room with nothing to do, and he started telling me about his book. And when he told me about it, I realized that I had been hearing some of these stories from my patients for a few years and not having any idea what they were. And suddenly it all became clear to me that this is part of a huge syndrome, not just a couple of crazy patients telling stories.
And he's actually working as your intern at that time.
Right, which is strange because he's actually older than I am.
Yeah.
But he had gotten his PhD and taught philosophy in college before he went to medical school.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever sat back and really looked at, as we've done in this series, the impact that you and Moody and others have had on popular culture? Over the last few weeks, we played clips of movies such as Resurrection, which came out in 1980, Ghost, which came out in 1990, and we just played a clip just a few minutes ago, Defending Your Life with Albert Brooks in 1991, which, of course, is perfect for the life review. I've never taken a look, you know, before Moody and your work, there was no Resurrection movie. There was no attempt in culture to recreate an NDE.
That's actually not true, Christopher. A colleague of mine, John Migliaccio, who himself had a near-death experience, has been collecting movies of near-death experiences going back to the 1920s. And granted, there aren't very many of them. But there are some that go back to black and white days and they're sporadic, but there are accounts of what we now call near-death experiences, because we didn't have a name for them.
Yeah, and of course, resurrection really tried to recreate the entire passage, life thing, people. I had never seen that before. You're probably right. Maybe Dr. Parnassus or some things about Tibet may have come out in the 20s and 30s and 40s. But as far as, it's just interesting that after Rudy's book is released, that now it starts moving into the zeitgeist.
Yes, yes.
An interesting also corollary, if I can make this pairing here, is that both you and Raisman come from backgrounds where there's not a whole lot of religion. There are dads who are kind of left-brained, if you will. Your dad is a chemist. He's very left-brained. There's really no religion per se in your family. And Moody's was a little similar, but talk about your background first.
Yeah, that's sure. Many of us who started doing this research had no religious or spiritual background. As you said, my father was a chemist. We had no religious or spiritual tradition in our family. So we just assumed that the physical world is all there is, and that was fine with us. That's just the way life is. And when you die, you die. So I went through college and medical school with that mindset. And then when I started hearing stories from patients, when I started my psychiatric training, about leaving their bodies when they were near death and seeing things from an out-of-body perspective, it just didn't make any sense to me.
And Raymond went through something similar. His dad was a doctor. He was a military vet. At least your dad hadn't committed to a psychiatric.
Raymond, there was one big difference in that Raymond had studied Greek philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew Plato's story of error from the Republic, which was a very graphic near-death experience. So when he started hearing about those in the 1970s, he recognized it as something that came from the ancient literature. And that intrigued him.
You know, it's so interesting. We talk a lot. I know you have talked about how scientific materialism always likes to push back against this, and we don't have proof and that sort of thing. And yet these stories go down through time. We started off tonight talking about the Armenian soldier, and also Sir Francis Beaufort. Now, these are, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of years old, but I think you hit the nail on the head. These stories really have always been with us. Why is this existence if they've always been with us?
Yeah.
Is it a myth?
Exactly. They're considered superstitions. Actually, people have found near-death experiences in every culture we've looked at. There were French fur trappers in the what's now the Minnesota area, Wisconsin area, who collected stories from the Native Americans they encountered. There have been stories collected from the Polynesians, from people in all different cultures, whether or not they have written record, but they tell stories of what we now call near-death experiences.
Tell us a story. I know you've said it before, so if you'd like to give us a condensed version, that's absolutely fine. But tell us about how you were first introduced to this notion that consciousness is not relegated to our cranium, and that it spooked you at first. Tell us a story about the young gal who tried to commit suicide and staying on your...
Yeah, this was one of my first days as an intern myself, Dom. And I was supposed to be covering the emergency room. And I was in the cafeteria eating my dinner when my pager went off, alerting me there was a call. And it kind of startled me. So I dropped my fork and spilled some spaghetti on my tie. I tried to wipe it off and couldn't. So I just picked up a white lab coat and buttoned it over my tie so no one would see it. And then I answered the page, and there was a patient who had come to the emergency room with an overdose that I was asked to evaluate. So I went down there, and she was totally unconscious. I couldn't arouse her. But her roommate had brought her in and was waiting to talk to me in another room down the hall. So I spent about 15, 20 minutes talking to the roommate. It was a very hot Virginia evening in the late summer of 1973 or 1972. We didn't have air conditioning back in those days. So I unbuttoned the coat so I wouldn't sweat so much, inadvertently exposing the stain on my tie. After I finished talking with her, I stood up to say goodbye to her and realized it was open, so I closed it up again so no one else would see it. Then I went back to see the patient, and she was still unconscious. So I arranged for her to be admitted to the intensive care unit overnight, and I would see her in the morning when she woke up. When I went the next morning, she was awake, very, very drowsy. I started to introduce myself, and she stopped me and said, "I know who you are. I remember you from last night." Kind of puzzled me, so I said something like, "Well, I thought you were unconscious when I saw you last night." She said, "Not in my room. I saw you talking to my roommate down the hall." I couldn't make any sense of that. The only way that could have happened if she had left her body and followed me down the hall, and that just didn't make any sense. You are your body. How can you leave it? So I tried to push that out of my mind for a few years until I talked to Raymond Moody, and he told me, no, these things really happen, and there are lots of them around if you just look for them.
So the interesting, so you had the experience, and that it was only afterwards.
Yeah.
Between talking to the likes of Ian Stevenson and Raymond Moody, there was, this is not an uncommon experience.
Right, right. But until I knew that, I didn't dare tell anyone about this. They'd think I was crazy. So I just kept it to myself.
Because, well, you know, it's interesting because, again, you've been studying these near-death experiences now for decades. And I think you've said that some 20 to 25% of the cases that you have studied, people experience a life review. What is that in your own words? And is that number about right?
Actually, it's a little higher than that now. It's probably around 30%. And these are people who have basically their life flashed before them as they are approaching death or sometimes pronounced dead. And they describe it in different ways. I can talk a little more about why they use different ways to describe it. But they all basically say that they review every incident of their life in minute detail. And we have descriptions. You mentioned Sir Francis Beaufort back in the 1800s. There were other cases going back to the Middle Ages where people say, I experienced it in great detail, not the way I'm telling you now in outline, but every little detail. Now, one of my subjects, Tom Sawyer, described going back to childhood and mowing the lawn on a hot day. And he said, in my life review, I could count the number of mosquitoes buzzing around me. I could have done it then, but then it was so clear, I knew. One of the most surprising things about this life review is that in about, almost 80% of those who have a life review, they re-experience events not only through their own eyes, but also through the eyes of other people involved in the situation. And I can give you an example of that also from Tom Sawyer, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
He had his near-death experience when he was in his 30s, and he was working underneath a truck, and it fell, and it crushed his chest, and he had his near-death experience. And among many other things, he had a very elaborate life review. And one incident he remembered was when he was a teenager, driving his truck down the street, and a drunk man wanted out in front of him, jammed on his brakes to stop, and then rolled his window down and started yelling at the man. And the man, being intoxicated, reached his hand inside the window and slapped Tom across the face. And that was too much for this hot-headed teenager. So he got out of the truck and started beating the man up. They left him a bloody pulp on the median strip and then drove off. When he had his life review, he said he remembered it all through his own eyes, feeling the adrenaline rush and the rage. And also, at the same time, through the eyes of the drunk man, feeling the humiliation of being beaten up by this young punk, and feeling the his nose getting bloody and his teeth going through his lower lip. And you know, Tom said to me later, that really convinced him that we're not separate individuals. We're all interconnected. And that when you hurt someone else, you're hurting yourself as well. And I hear this again and again from near-death experiencers that when they experience things through other people's eyes that they had done, they suddenly understand that we're all part of the same thing.
There's the one mind right there.
Exactly.
So when these people go through the life review, is there any judgment? Is there any self-judgment? Is there an angel guide? What's going on in these life reviews?
Yeah. Well, most of them say that there is no judgment by an other being, no God, no angel judging them. But they sort of judge themselves, not in the sense of saying that they've sinned. They don't talk about sin, but they talk about having to experience the pain they cause other people in their life review and realizing what they could have done better than they did the first time. And when they come back, they're kind of determined to do things better the next time.
So I don't have a prosecutor and I don't have a defense counsel like Rip Torn in Defending Your Life.
Right.
You got to love the way they put that movie.
Yes. Yes.
Because again, you may have heard, you've heard of movies before that, but of course you know, when I started watching movies in the 70s and 80s, of course, there was nothing quite like it. Let's just dig down a little bit further there. Now, some people will say that there is an angelic guide of some sort.
Yes.
That's not judging them, correct? Just leading them through the experience of what they experience, what the other person experiences in that exchange.
Right, right.
I don't know about you, but if I was going to be the designer of the universe, maybe that's how I design it.
Well,
get to feel the feelings of what you,
yes.
You know, but whether it's good or bad, right?
Exactly. And it
felt that.
Yeah. It's usually a mixture of good and bad, because nothing we do is all good or all bad. And you get to appreciate that we're all part of the same thing. We all have the same faults and the same advantages. And that leads people to kind of live by the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which is part of every religion that we have.
Mm-hmm.
But for the near-death experiencer, it's no longer a guideline we're supposed to follow. They've experienced it as a law of the universe. This is the way things work. You hurt someone else, you hurt yourself. When you help other people, you help yourself as well, because we're all interconnected.
Yeah, things that every religion teaches.
Exactly.
Now, something else interesting that you said in your wonderful book, which again is right there on the bookshelf, is that about half the experiences said that in the afterlife will be able to watch loved ones who are still alive.
Boom. Yeah.
It's a big number.
It is, yeah. People going through a near-death experience are just barely over the line, if they are over the line. And it may be that for a while, you can hang around and see what's going on in this world, in this life. And after a while, that door kind of closes. Or it may be that you sort of get more interested in things going on in the other world as well, and less interested in following things here. Many people, as you said, will hang around their body and watch what's going on, watch the resuscitation attempts and so forth, and see how their families are reacting and so forth, and sometimes try to communicate with loved ones and usually fail.
It's what's interesting is that, again, some of the research in that brilliant Netflix series that you and Dr. Tucker were both in, I also was really intrigued by those people who are getting ready to pass over, those people usually in hospice. It seems to me that some of the experiences that they have, and my mother-in-law had the same experience where she's starting to see people.
Right.
Where she's a day or two away from death. We didn't know it at the time, but she's starting to see people and hear people. This is almost like a segue, literally, between, you know, the physical life and the afterlife. So it shares a lot in common with the near-death experience.
It certainly does, yeah. Yeah. Now, because they don't come back and tell us about it the way near-death experiences do, these are often dismissed by healthcare workers as saying, oh, just hallucinations. You know, they're getting delirious. They're starting to imagine these things. But sometimes they bring back information from the deceased loved ones that they couldn't have known any other way.
And really, you know, we talk about the phenomenon. Look, it is mind-blowing. That's part of what we're here to talk about. And I think it's important we discuss that. But really, these stories, most importantly, are about transformation and renewal.
Exactly. Right. You know, a lot of people are fascinated by near-death experiences because of what they may tell us about life after death. Most near-death experiences themselves will tell you that what's more important is what they tell us about life before death, life right now. Yes, we may be somewhere else after death, but we're here now, so let's deal with this. And they feel like life becomes much more meaningful, much more enjoyable for them, because they now become aware of the meaning and purpose in everything, and the interconnection between all people, all of the natural, and between us and the divine.
You know, a few weeks ago, we were taking a look at some people who believe that consciousness is not local and some who don't. And we studied or we reviewed some of the work by Dr. Susan Blackmore from England. I no doubt you're familiar with her work. She wrote Home, Consciousness, and Introduction. And she's an atheist. And for a while there, you know, she was writing, Richard Dawkins was writing forwards to her books and that sort of thing. But it was interesting that after she seemed to join that psychop side of the ledger, over the years, she started moving away from the dying brain theory. She said that religion was no longer some toxic elixir in our lives. And I love what she had to say. When you study consciousness, it will change your life. And I mean, even if you haven't gone through an NDE, if you study NDEs and life reviews, it will change your life.
It definitely will. And we have evidence for that now as well. There have been about five studies done of college students, mostly, who have taken a class in near-death experiences. Ken Ring did two of these studies early on, back in the 80s. And they find that if you test students before the class, after the class, and then a year or two after, they become much more caring, much more compassionate, much more altruistic in their behavior after the class.
So let me ask you somewhat of a personal question. If you came from a background that was atheistic, or let's say agnostic, that's my read on it, how does that change someone with that kind of background? Was a scientist first and foremost, there's no doubt about that. How does that change your beliefs?
We have to make a distinction between science and materialism. You know, science is the idea of understanding the world around us by posing questions, developing hypotheses, and then collecting information to find the answer. And materialism is belief that the material world is all there is, and anything else is imaginary. And people often confound the two. They are not the same by any means. Science is a method for learning the truth. Materialism is a philosophy. I started out as both a scientist and a materialist. And I think I still am a scientist and a skeptic.
You do?
But I am no longer a materialist. I don't think materialism can explain all the things that we've seen. There's just no way you can explain how people can leave their bodies and see things from an out-of-body perspective and can seem to still communicate after they have died, after their bodies have died. So clearly, if those things are happening, and I believe they are, we have to be more than just our material bodies.
And don't you think, in fact, I'm writing a book about this right now, the whole notion of convergence between, you know, mysticism, religion, science, and atheism. And I've got to think that the work that you're doing, that Randy Mooney has been doing, that Tucker, Stevenson, Dean Radin, I could name another dozen names, it is creating a convergence of these various belief systems. I'll put atheism there as a belief system as well. And that this convergence starts to narrow the ability, or let's put it this way, it lessens the notion of seeing these various belief systems as compartmentalized. Right. Do you feel that in some ways, this is both a scientific and a spiritual revolution that we are experiencing and will experience here in this century?
It definitely is. And I think a lot of spiritual leaders will share that idea. Certainly the Dalai Lama does. And the Pope does also right now. In addition, there are many of the scientific leaders in our community who will also endorse the same thing. People like Carl Sagan, who were often held as a, you know, prime skeptic, said that science is this one of the most powerful sources of spiritualism. So I think people appreciate that there's both a scientific side and a spiritual side to us and to everything we do. Unless you understand both of them, you don't quite understand what's going on with us.
And once again, what's interesting is why there's been such a resistance to science. And maybe this is something left over from the Council of Trent in the 1500s, where the church said, we'll make religion, you scientists have material stuff, and never the twain shall meet. And yet we had great quantum physicists in the 30s. I'm thinking of Schrodinger and Planck, and you know all the other names, Wigner and many others, who talked about consciousness being absolutely fundamental.
Right.
So you've got to think that maybe science is going to come back around to, I mean, Einstein as well talked about the cosmos, talked about mysticism.
Right.
You've got people like Sam Harris today talking about, you know, spirituality without religion. It's almost as if, and this is what I was talking about a moment ago, this gap, let's say, between atheism and spirituality is winnowing. And it's also winnowing the gap between perhaps spirituality and orthodox religions.
I'm not sure about that last part.
Okay, we'll get to that.
But certainly the gap between traditional science and an appreciation for the spiritual world is getting narrower and narrower. And there have been some recent studies of surveys of scientists in Scotland, in Belgium, in Brazil, and in the U.S. Saying that more than half of all scientists believe that the mind and the brain are not the same thing, that there is something non-physical in the mind that works with brain. Science, properly understood, keeps adjusting its ideas according to what the new evidence shows. and that's why I think science is making progress towards appreciating spirituality. Traditional religions are less willing to do that because many of them take as their touchstone of truth a revealed truth that came from usually centuries ago, if not millennia ago. And they are not really willing to change those according to new evidence comes up. Now, that's not true of all religions. Certainly, the Dalai Lama says that's not true of Buddhism. That, you know, if we show him that, say, reincarnation doesn't exist by scientific evidence, he will give up his belief in that.
Right. And we're here in Virginia, which is also the land of Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and some really dyed-in-the-wool orthodoxies. And what's interesting about your work is I suspect at first blush there isn't bad news for fundamentalists and evangelicals and dyed-in-the-wool Christians or any mainstream religion is that, number one, your work seems to suggest, even if it's not dispositive, that consciousness exists after the body dies. Good news for the religionist, if you will. Not so good news is the fact that we're all on the same even keel, whether you're atheist or whether you're bad man or what have you. There's probably such a thing as reincarnation, if you ask the works of Jim Tucker, and that consciousness continues and that there's no judgment. So it's a kind of a push for major religions, wouldn't you say?
It is. It is. You know, most religions feel that they are the one true religion. And near-death experiences almost universally say there is no one true religion. They're all the same. And they come back with a sense of heightened spirituality, but not religious devotion.
Although, and that's why I think the work that you've done and Jim Tucker and, again, Dean Radin and many others is going to, I still think it's going to start eroding not only that strict scientific materialistic fundamentalism or even atheistic fundamentalism, but I think fundamentalism of all stripes. So we'll, obviously the jury is still out. We're going to have to watch and see what happens
right
here. Tell us a little bit how this Netflix series has changed your life and the work that you guys have been doing at Dom's.
You know, I don't really think it has. It's gotten us some more publicity. We get more people communicating with us, but it really hasn't changed what we do or how we look at things.
And what about the work at IANS? Because again, you helped, I didn't realize this until I died. The International Association of Near-Death Studies, which you're a co-founder of. Just tell us a little bit about what's going on there and what's cutting edge in that realm.
Yeah. Well, IANS was really started back in the late 70s and around 1980, when a bunch of us who had read Raymond Moody's book decided we wanted to study it as well. And we were all researchers at that point. So the organization was started to give us like support for each other. And as the organization got going, it became more and more obvious that a greater need was to support the experiencers themselves. And over the last several decades, IANS has become less and less a support for researchers and more focusing on the experiencers' needs and how we can help them. I think it's still continuing in that vein, that it's becoming more and more an organization for experiencers and people who are concerned about death and dying issues and about the healthcare around death and dying.
Mm-hmm. And I have to thank you for so many things, but one of them is the Tauntaun Festival a few years ago. You've got to love it when you can get a John Cleese and Monty Python on the lunch, join your paddle. That's got to help, right?
Yes, yes.
You mean, obviously brings a certain, I love the way he started. He says, I'm here for one reason, I'm a celebrity, you see. But Cleese is very much, I mean, he's very much into this. And here's, you know, a guy with the race mind, if you will, starting to question our scientific views of reality.
That's right. That's right. He's recently come up with he wrote an editorial for a magazine in Australia, which he said point blank that he believes that death is not the end, that there's continued consciousness after death.
Well, I hope we'll say that on Bill Maher's program sometime, you know, that Bill who produced the program Religious, and maybe again, we're starting to see, people are starting to appreciate the difference between spiritual questers, spiritual seekers, if you will, versus orthodox recipient.
Right.
Let me finish with this, and there's no definitive answer here whatsoever. I obviously have an opinion. But do you think this is the kind of thing that Thomas Jefferson started this university 200 and some odd years ago would have been proud of, the work that you guys are doing at Dobbs, whether it's about reincarnation or NDEs?
I think that's very true. He was a seeker of the truth. He was a true scientist. And in fact, he said several times that, you know, we shouldn't be afraid of making mistakes and coming up with wrong ideas as long as we have science to correct ourselves later on. You know, that's the way science works. We know now that what people thought 100 years ago was ludicrous. And this goes back that way throughout centuries. We keep coming up with better and better ideas. So how can anyone think that what we think now is the way things really are? Because we know that 100 years from now, people laugh at us.
That's right. So you think about, you know, the early foundation of the country and deism and then transcendentalism 100 years later. Maybe William James is right. Maybe New Thought will become the predominant religious expression in this country if, again, it's more of a spiritual, not religious expression, and where we honor science and we honor our spiritual foundations. Well, Grace, I'm sorry, continue.
I was going to say, Jeff Kreipel has a great phrase, the religion of no religion.
There you go. There you go. Dr. Grayson, thank you so much. Loved your book, After. I know it's our first conversation. I trust it won't be our last. Thanks for joining us today, and also continue the great work you're doing there at the UVA Dobbs.
Thank you, Christopher.
A gracious thank you for Dr. Bruce Grayson for joining me today. Quick reminder, please click on subscribe, like, or comment. Again, it helps get a program such as this out to many people, such as yourself. For all of us here at New Thinking Aloud, for longtime host Jeffrey Mishlove, co-host Emmy Vadnais, all the great volunteers here at NTA, I'm Christopher Naughton. Thank you for joining us. You are the reason that we're here.
I imagine that by now, many of you already realize that, in conjunction with White Crow Books, we've just launched the new Thinking Aloud Dialogues book imprint, and our first title is There Life After Death? New Thinking Aloud is a nonprofit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.